WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Greil Marcus was one of the first critics to write about rock and roll as seriously as others had written about literature and film. He was the first record review editor at Rolling Stone magazine. He now writes a music column for The Village Voice and a book column for California Magazine. Greil Marcus's 1975 book Mystery Train is still considered one of the seminal works of rock criticism. He said he didn't set out to write a history or a purely musical analysis or a set of personality profiles. He wanted to broaden the context in which rock and roll is heard, to deal with rock and roll not as youth culture or counterculture, but simply as American culture. A revised edition of Mystery Train has just been published. We invited Marcus to talk with us about some of the ideas in the book and to play some of the records he wrote about. He connects rock and roll to the American impulse to escape from restraints and authority.
The real American story is this wish to escape, is the classic Huck Finn lighting out for the territory. But also, then, after the escape has been made, coming to terms with the home that's been left behind, and in one of many senses, returning to that home. So there's a real pull in both directions. It's not simply a story of escape and rebellion. And I think, you know, that comes through most clearly, perhaps, in the story of Elvis Presley and in the story of Sly Stone, both people who, in a sense, made their escapes from the cultures they'd inherited and brought up in, and were basically destroyed by their inability to find their way to any kind of home.
You know, in trying to define the essence of rock and roll, you go back to an obscure singer named Harmonica Frank, someone who I should say I've never heard, although I've read about him in your book. What are some of the qualities that he had that you think foreshadowed rock and roll?
Well, what interested me about Harmonica Frank, he was a white medicine show performer. He began performing in the 20s and kept playing and singing all around the country up until the 1950s when he made his first records, and then for a good 25 years after that. He was someone who drew on every style of American vernacular music that he could get his hands on: blues, country, scatological songs, commercial jingles, everything anybody wanted to hear and would give him a dime for. And in 1951, in Memphis, when Sam Phillips was starting Sun Records and was beginning to get this idea that if he could find a white man who could get the feeling of black music, he could make a lot of money, he stumbled on Harmonica Frank, who people who heard him sing often thought was black because he seemed to have absorbed the black feel as much as any other white man. And so Sam Phillips thought, well, I'll give it a try. I'll record this guy. And he did, and he made remarkable records. And they don't so much foreshadow rock and roll in terms of musical style, but they definitely foreshadow it in terms of impulse, in terms of an attempt of whites to cross over and really attach themselves to what up until that point, and in many ways still today, is considered someone else's culture.
You brought something of Harmonica Frank's to play for us. What did you bring?
I brought a song called Going Away Walkin', which is a country blues. And to me, it's his strongest, most moving performance. I don't know if it's his most typical. It's not one of the ones where he plays two harmonicas at the same time, one in his mouth held like a cigar and the other one with his nose, also singing at the same time. But it's a pretty strong piece of music.
Why don't we give it a listen?
Okay.
Shoes clean off. was burning in my shoes clean, oh. I'm gonna find that joker took my good gal on.
It's Harmonica Frank, one of the records that Greil Marcus has brought with us. And Harmonica Frank is one of the people Greil writes about in his book Mystery Train, which has just been published in a new edition. Well, let's move on to Robert Johnson, another musician who you write about in Mystery Train. And you describe Johnson as the most emotionally committed of blues singers. Now, what impact do you think Robert Johnson has on rock and roll? What is it about him that connects to rock and roll?
Well, Johnson's had an enormous impact on guitar players, on singers. He was a blues singer, was born in 1911. He was murdered in 1938, was from Mississippi. And he was a great musician. But he was also a dark and confused and in some ways almost nihilist figure, both in terms of the legend of his life and the songs that he wrote. Songs like Hellhound on My Trail is probably his most famous and most emblematic. And he's become a kind of shadow hero to all kinds of musicians, a figure who represents how far you can really go in pursuit of your own music. But Johnson appealed to me in trying to construct a tradition that would begin to make sense of rock and roll as a kind of American culture, because it seemed that he captured more deeply than any other musician the sense of doubt and contingency and uncertainty that lies behind any impulse toward rebellion or escape. I mean, this was a man who lived an itinerant life, who left everyone behind at one time or another, whose songs are filled with regret at the fact that he has to live a life without any kind of solace. And it is not a celebration. It is not, I don't need anybody. I'm my own man. I'm free. It's about the doubts that come with freedom. And I've never heard that expressed more powerfully than in his music.
What did you bring by Robert Johnson to play for us?
I brought a song called Come On in My Kitchen, which is maybe the most delicate of all of his recordings. It was recorded in 1936.
Did Robert Johnson have on you when you first started listening to his records?
Well, I discovered Robert Johnson's music in 1970, right after the Altamont Rock Festival, or whatever the hell it was, the great Rolling Stones show with 300,000 people that was, you know, utterly dominated by violence and beating and horror and ended with murder, which was probably the ugliest day of my whole life up to that point. And after I left that concert sick of rock and roll, just full of confusion and disgust. And I needed to listen to something else. And I stumbled on a Robert Johnson album, and I saw that, oh, there's a song on here. It's the same song Cream recorded. I wonder why it's the same title. So I bought it and took it home. I didn't listen to anything else for the next year.
But you got back to rock and roll, I guess.
Oh, yeah, I got that.
Let's move on to Elvis Presley, another one of the performers who you write about in Mystery Train. You describe Elvis as a great artist, a great rocker, a great purveyor of schlock, a great heartthrob, a great boor, a great symbol of potency, a great ham, a great nice person, and yes, a great American. Now, Elvis Presley was often accused of being like the supreme example of the white person who stole music from blacks, passed it off as original, made a fortune while the black originators remained obscure. And you really think that that attitude is nonsense?
Yeah, I do. I think it's one of the great simplicities that we cling to avoid having to think about where our culture really comes from, what it really does, and what it's really about. I think the idea that an utterly a white Mississippi boy like Elvis Presley from an utterly impoverished background who listened to black music on the radio against his parents' wishes, who had to find for himself as a teenager a life that he could call his own, that he actually wanted to live, and began to do that by sneaking across town into black neighborhoods, finding black girlfriends, who began to haunt Beale Street, who began to go into the black social clubs where music was played every weekend, and ultimately got up the nerve to ask if he could sing for the crowd too, something that was absolutely unheard of in Memphis in 1953, 1954, for a white kid to walk in and want to play and then do it and have the people who listen to the greatest blues singers in the country every weekend cheer him and say, there's something different here. There's something fresh. That was a revolutionary act. The idea that he stole that music as opposed to made it his own is a cheap way of saying, we white people have our culture, black people have their culture. What's wrong with that? You know, separate but equal. And I think, you know, that disgraceful ideology has persisted in culture with a tinge of legitimacy far more than it's persisted in politics. Not that it hasn't persisted in truth in politics, but the legitimacy is gone.
But do you think there have been examples, even if Elvis Presley isn't one of them, of white musicians ripping off black culture and passing it off as their own?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, it's, you know, one of the most commonplace stories we've got. But what interests me, what I think is much more paradoxical, much more fun to listen to, much more fun to write about, is when a white musician finds something in black music that he actually can contribute to, that he can bring something of himself to that music or herself to that music rather than simply taking, or vice versa. Sly Stone, another of the people that I write about, a black musician, was utterly energized by white music, by Bob Dylan, by the Beatles, by all kinds of music. And he had no interest whatsoever in performing music that anyone could pigeonhole as black. He wanted to be, in Albert Murray's wonderful phrase, an omni-American.
Grill Marcus is my guest, and his book about rock and roll, Mystery Train, has just been published in a new edition. You named your book after one of Elvis Presley's early recordings, Mystery Train.
Right.
Why did you name your whole book after that one record?
Well, it wasn't really till I had finished writing the book, and I ended a very long chapter on Elvis Presley with some talk about that song, Mystery Train, that it suddenly struck me that this one song probably contained more of the contradictions that I was trying to talk about between escape and homecoming, between rebellion and acceptance, than any other song that I'd come across. Plus, it's a great title. It's a great title. It was a great title for that song. It was a good title for my book. Jim Jarmusch liked it for his movie. A new book of poems by someone named David Wohan has just come out with the same title. There's a record store in Boston called Mystery Train Records. It's irresistible.
Why don't we hear it? This is Elvis Presley's recording of Mystery Train. It's one of his early Sun Sessions. Mm-hmm.
baby, and go.
Elvis Presley's Mystery Train. You know, one of the really fascinating things that makes Elvis Presley as complex as he was is some of the other influences that go in there along with the black music influences. People, and you mentioned this in your book, people like Dean Martin and Mario Lanza, who you don't really think of as being his influences. But I think you can hear that kind of like deep mumbly quality of Dean Martin in his singing.
Oh, yeah, and you can hear, you know, the wish to really be a bel canto blues singer. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Everything feeds in, you know, whether it's country music, whether it's, I mean, I guess you just said Mario Lanza. I mean, you can hear a lot of that.
Your book Mystery Train was first written in the mid-1970s, or was published in the mid-1970s.
Right.
I want to ask you about a current form of music, and that is rap. It's one of the most popular forms of music now, yet it's probably the music that's most under attack. A lot of early rock and roll was very controversial with parents and teachers, you know, PTAs and people, you know, a lot of adults were really afraid of the influence this raucous sexual music was going to have on their youth. Do you see rap as an extension of that in any way?
Well, it certainly seems to be drawing the heat. I think what we're faced with now, I mean, thinking of Two Live Crew in Florida, where it seems as if the entire Bill of Rights has been abrogated. I think there has been an urge in this country for a long time to find scapegoats. I think the right in this country is looking desperately for an issue now that the abortion issue seems to be falling away from them. I think Two Live Crew at this point are absolutely classic scapegoats because they're black and because they sing about sex. The Newsweek cover, the notorious Newsweek cover, has rap gone too far, whatever the exact wording was a classic example of what some critical theorists like to call the dominant society attempting to suppress anything different. That was a pure piece of racism and scare stuff. I think this is part and parcel with trying to drum up hysteria over flag burning. And I think whenever you have black people talking out loud and not really attempting to shade what they're saying for anybody's benefit, they're going to be targets.
I should mention here that you're on the record of as having serious problems with at least one rap group and things that they've done, and that's Public Enemy. There's a Village Voice annual pop music poll that you refuse to participate in. You want to explain your rationale for that?
Well, I think a lot of what Public Enemy has done is utterly disgraceful. Mm-hmm. I think there are many of the things that they've put out are racist, they're anti-Semitic, they're homophobic, they're viciously sexist, and I think the way that they have been treated by many, many white critics is in some ways even at least as disgusting as and reprehensible as what the group itself has done, which is to say they've just been given complete dispensation because, I mean, these guys are really down on the street and they're saying what's happening and they're hip and they're black and maybe they're not smart enough to know that anti-Semitism isn't cool, but they're where it's at. That is just as racist coming from a white critic as jumping on Two Live Crew because they speak a language that, you know, some white people don't want to hear. So I'm perfectly happy, you know, as a listener to attack something that I think is corrupt. And I think a lot of what Public Enemy does is corrupt. But there's no question their music is powerful. There's no question that Chuck D, their leader, is a thoughtful, tough-minded, smart guy. And, you know, he's somebody worth reckoning with. My opposition to that group or to a lot of what it does doesn't exist in the realm of saying, I want them to stop saying that. They shouldn't be allowed to say that. People shouldn't listen to it. I was making a protest against the dispensation I thought that many people at The Voice were offering this band.
Well, Greil, we're just about out of time. Why don't we end with maybe a record that you wish you had included in your book, Mystery Train, in retrospect? Is there
All
such
right.
a record?
All right, well, sure. One thing that Mystery Train is not about is women.
Uh-huh.
That's something that's left out of the book, and were I to really sit down and were I to write the book today, the book is written, the book is what it is, but were I to write it today, that would be something that I'd have to wrestle with. And I think, you know, I might write about Laurie Anderson, or I might write about the Chantels, black New York City girl group from the 50s. They recorded only a very, very few songs that really count. And it'd be a real challenge to try and make a world out of those few songs. They had a singer named Arlene Smith, 15 years old, maybe the strongest voice in all of rock and roll. I'd like to write about that.
Before we hear from Arlene Smith and the Chantels, let me thank you, Greil Marcus, very much for talking with us.
It's always a pleasure.
Greil Marcus's book, Mystery Train, is just out in its third revised edition, published by Dutton. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and this is the Chantels.